Yeshiva Shaarei Torah presents lecture number 88, entitled Man and Civilization, delivered by Rabbi Beryl Wein, November 3, 1987. This tape is dedicated to the memory of Miriam Basora Moses, whose yahrzeit is 5 Kislev, by her children, Dr. James and Joanne Weiss.
There are matters of history that are really matters more for conjecture than they are for historic facts. The ideas of man in his original state, how man began, and the origins of civilization is one of those areas. We have not been blessed enough yet to ascertain hard evidence, empiric evidence of how man started. There are differences of opinion where man started, what part of the world. The entire history of the human race, at least in terms of its inception, is shrouded in mystery. And because of that, therefore, it is skating on thin ice for me to attempt, even though nobody knows more history than I do, to attempt to explain to you historically the origins of man. But there are insights, Jewish insights. This is a Jewish history course, and as a Jewish history course, at least my intent is that the course is not only about Jews, but that it's given from a traditional Jewish viewpoint. Every history has a bias. There's no such thing as an unbiased history. There's no such thing as the recording of facts alone, because the simple choice of what facts you're going to tell itself is a bias. And therefore, the bias here is that it's a Jewish history. It's not a history of the Jews. It's a Jewish history. And I think that that's a fundamental difference that at least I feel that it justifies perhaps the course. And it certainly makes it worth all the money that all of you people are paying to enjoy it. In the Jewish viewpoint, man is the purpose for the universe. It is not that there is a universe with all of the myriads of complicated organisms which exist in the world, and the technology and everything else, and that man somehow is here. But that everything that's here is here for man, for mankind, for the human race. In Hebrew, the rabbis framed it that man is the Bechir HaYetzirah. He is the chosen of all that has been created. And in Pirkei Avos we say, Chiba Yaseiron Adaslo, a special love was exhibited to man because he was created in the image of the Creator. The image of the Creator is not that Chas V'Sholem God has kaviyochel a nose or ears, etc. But the image of the Creator is that God invested in man godly qualities which do not exist in any other creature on the face of the universe. And those godly qualities is what characterizes man, what makes him different, and what makes his story so fascinating. Now, if one can deal with that, then one is dealing on one plane. If one, however, says the history of man is like the history of the cow or the history of the elephant, so then you're dealing on a completely different plane. The Chumash, Chumash is not a history book, but it is the sense of history that beats within the Jewish people. The Chumash introduces itself as Zeh Sefer Toldos Odom. This is the book of man. This is the story of man, of mankind. And then the Chumash proceeds to tell us very little about man or mankind, because the Chumash is not a history book. It comes to give us insights into human beings and the human race. And those insights don't change, as I hope we'll see here tonight. They don't change from time to time. Circumstances change, technology changes, even perhaps organisms can change, but the basic problems of being human do not change. The basic problems of who takes out the garbage and how the bills are met And what is the meaning of all of this? And how can I live in peace with my neighbor who's such an idiot? Those problems don't change. And that's what the Chumash means, that this is the book of man. This is what we're coming to talk about. Inherent in such a viewpoint is that we have to know the story of what happened. We have to be able to trace civilization. We have to be able to trace man. So I'd like to talk about three different viewpoints of man, and then we'll talk about civilization. And this basically covers the first 1,500, according to Jewish tradition, the first 1,536 years of mankind till the flood. Now, rabbis say 10 generations from original man till Noah, 10 generations till the flood. And that, we have it charted out specifically as to exactly how the generations were and where they lived and what they did. And that takes us the first 1,536 years. That's essentially tonight's lecture. That's pretty good, 1,536 years and 58 minutes. But, you know, we're on fast forward, so we'll hear it. The first point that has to be understood regarding man, and the Chumash expresses it to us in the famous story of man in the Garden of Eden. There is man, idealized man, man in his highest state, mankind the way it should be, and then there's man. Right? Then there's getting on the bus in New York, or the subway, or standing in line, or more unpleasant situations, which history basically is. History basically is very unpleasant. Now, in Christianity, that's called man before the fall and man after the fall. Summer and winter. And man before the fall is man without sin, without original sin, and man after the fall is born immediately into sin. There is no human being that is not a sinner automatically. In other words, according to basic Christian theology, the moment a person is born, he's going to go to hell unless he does something to get out of it. According to Judaism, a person, Kol Yisrael Yeshalem Chelek Olam Abo, a person is born with an eternal soul and will automatically inherit the world to come unless he botches it up. Which is not hard to do if you put your mind to it. But it's two different viewpoints of man completely. So Christianity has made man before the fall and man after the fall a purely theological issue. Judaism has no theology. We don't know much about theology. We know very little about God. We don't really bother with it that much. Or in the words of our rabbis, Alavai, Osi, Ozvu, Vitorosi, Shomoru, would that they forgot about me. And, you know, if we closed up all the divinity schools in the world, but if everybody would stop for the traffic light, and people wouldn't shoot each other, it would be a much better world. That, in essence, is the pragmatic Jewish viewpoint of the matter. People will observe the Torah so you can forget about me, right? Don't philosophize about things that are beyond you. So in the Jewish viewpoint, original man before the sin, that was idealized man. That's how man is someday going to be yet. That is utopia. But not utopia in a theological sense, but in a physical sense. Thus, utopia is, I don't know what, used to be a BMW. I don't know what it is today. But in our society at least, we translate utopia in very physical terms. The utopia is translatable in physical terms. That's the description of the Garden of Eden, right? You don't have to work. The only lasting vestige of that type of a job is the rabbinate. You don't have to work. and you have, you know, three meals a day. You can eat all the fruit and vegetables you want. It's a healthy diet. There's no fear of death. There's no competition. There's no tension, no stress. That's idealized man. That's man before the chet, before the sin. And the second viewpoint of man is what happens to him afterwards. Afterwards is our world. Right? You plant wheat and it may grow thistles. So it doesn't have to be wheat and thistles, right? You can have a great idea for a business and work on it 30 years and it doesn't happen. Not for any lack of effort and not for any lack of intelligence. Everything was right, but it didn't go. That's the curse of man. When we read the curse in the Chumash, you have to understand that the curse is not... The curse is that we live in an imperfect world. Idealized man is not here. And therefore, all of these things happen. The Etzef told Teildi Bonim, right? We have children in sadness. Why do people... But you see, the world has children in sadness. I was 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, somebody came and told me that they had a child. Oh, I remember where it was. It wasn't here. It was in Memphis last week. And somebody came and told me that his wife is expecting a child. And he came to me and I'm magnanimous on somebody else's back. I said, oh, that's terrific and everything. So he says, you know, Rabbi, we can't afford it. Woe to a child that comes in the world, his father thinks he can't afford it. Whenever you look at that kid, right? There went my retirement, or there went my vacation, or there went whatever went. But that is how the world looks at it today. That's, you know, when you talk about population control and everything else, the inner syndrome within us is be'etzef teil dibonim. You are giving birth to children in sadness. You are perpetuating yourself. It's not limited to the pain of childbirth. It's an attitude that the Chumash describes for us. That's man after the idealized state. I mentioned to someone about losing money or losing his business, that there's a famous story that I heard it from my father-in-law, should live and be well, a few times, and I've seen it written also that in the Chofetz Chaim, the great Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen, had a student that was his premier student. He later became one of the great Rosh Yeshiva in the world. But it was his premier student that he invested in him as only a teacher can invest in a student, his heart and his soul and his mind and everything, and he wanted him to turn out. And the student realized the ultimate goal of every yeshiva student, he married a rich girl. But the father-in-law, you know, with the rich girl comes the father-in-law. And the father-in-law said to him after a year or two, he said, you know, enough of this. You know, you're sitting and learning and everything. It's time. You know, I want you to come into business with me. And he came into business with him, and he was a very brilliant person, a hard-working person, and God helped that the business went bankrupt in 6 months. The whole empire collapsed. He had nothing to do with himself. He was out of business. He was penniless. So he came back to the yeshiva, he came back to Radin, to the Chofetz Chaim's yeshiva, and he slunk in, his tail between his legs. You can imagine, he was embarrassed, he went away, you know, the big man, he's going out into the world to make it, he's back in 6 months. So the Chofetz Chaim saw that he was sad. He saw that he was embarrassed. So the Chofetz Chaim called him in, he said, I don't understand you, he said. God did you such a favor, he said, sometimes a person has to work 60, 70 years to lose it all. He said, and you did it in 6 months, it's over. Now you can go back to learn. Now that's such a Jewish story. That's such a viewpoint of life. So that's Adam after the sin, right? You know, all of these things can happen. Some, you know, Madame Hopmuch and Zibit Sigyor to lose it all, right? At the end, you know, it can happen. That's the curse. So that's the burden that man begins with. All of those tensions, all of those problems. And then we see immediately the problems of life that we know, right? He's got his wife, which is a problem automatically. and then he has two children, and the children can't agree. Talmud, in its viewpoint of things, says that it's an argument about turf. The argument about turf is not because there are 4.5 billion people in the world. So we say the world is too crowded. If there were less people in the world, you know, the Chinese have to expand. Hitler said Germany needs Lebensraum. That's all baloney. With two people in the world, right? So one guy will take Florida, one guy will take California, right? And there's enough to go around. So the Talmud says they killed each other over a piece of ground, right? This one said it's my piece of ground, and this one said, and the piece of ground happened to be Jerusalem. Happened to be the place of the temple. But how much? It's 500 cubits by 500 cubits, right? It's 1,000 feet by 1,000 feet. Yeah. Two people. That's the nature of man. The nature of man is a struggle for turf. It's not so much what I have, it's that I don't want you to have. It's not so much that it's necessary for me, it's just necessary for me that you shouldn't have it. All of that is mirrored in the story of Embracius. All of that is mirrored in the first discussion of man. So the first idea that we have about man is that there is man in an idealized state and a man in the realistic state. And part of what gnaws at all human beings and gnaws at civilization, and it's a record of human history, is the fact that man realizes that somehow this is not the way it's supposed to be. That it could be better. You know, there's an ad for beer that says, you know, it doesn't get any better than this. Right. If you're drinking a glass of beer on a fishing canoe, so it doesn't get any better than this. But we all know that it does, that it somehow it does get better. It's got to get better. I mean, that can't be it. And part of what drives all human beings is that a piece of us knows that once we were in better shape. And we know that somehow we can get back to that. And therefore, that's the inner tension, the inner frustration that exists, that really fuels civilization. The fact that man is never satisfied. Why is he not satisfied? He's not satisfied because a piece of him says, You go show somebody, you think this is something. You know, last year I was here, right? Think this is a vacation. Wait till you go there. Your mother-in-law always talks to you like that, right? Nothing is ever good enough. That's part of us. That psychological makeup that the Chumash points out to it, that's part of us. That's point number one about man. Point number two about man, which is the history of man, the Torah tells us, Asher Boro Elokim La'asos. God left over in the world room for man. The world was not complete. Wasn't finished. God, if he wanted to, could have created the world in a completed state. You could have roads and sewers and electric lights and everything. Why do we need the developmental process, which is the story of civilization, the story of human beings? So again, from a non-Jewish viewpoint, so we say, well, original man was an ape, was an idiot. You know, he couldn't figure out 2 plus 2 equals 4. And over thousands of years, we've improved. And now we all go to college, and Edison invented the electric bulb, and et cetera, et cetera. And then we figured it out, and that's why we're where we're at today. But the Jewish viewpoint of it is that our ancestors, who may have been cavemen or may have been in the Stone Age, were not intellectually deficient. They were not less than we were. But that God put them into an underdeveloped world, so to speak. He put them into a world that would require human development. And that's the Jewish viewpoint, that man is a partner in the process of creation. If God would have created a world that's completely finished, everything is perfect, so then what share do I have in it? What did I contribute? What is my reason for existence, even? What difference does it make if I passed here or I didn't? So the second idea, which is, again, an intrinsic, basic Jewish idea which colors all history, is that man is a developmental creature. It is a process that continues to go on and on and on. And that process that goes on and on and on is what we call civilization, whether it be technological civilization, whether it be the conquest of disease, whether it be economics, whatever field of human endeavor, it's always lassos. There's room not only for improvement, but there's room to develop, room to expand. There's constant room. Our rabbis, in their inimitable fashion, phrased it regarding even Torah itself. The Torah was given complete, but there's room in Torah for every person to add his own little bit to help develop it. So they said, Mokum hinichu avosenu lihisgader bo. Our forefathers left over a space where you still could build the fence. There's, you know, it's not all fenced in. It's not all complete. Well, if that's a viewpoint of life, so then history takes on a different meaning. It takes on a different coloration. We're viewing a different type of process. Again, we're not viewing it just as a matter of facts that occur. This and this year, this and this man was a king, and he made war, and he was defeated, and he won. That's history. Those are facts, and they're pretty boring, dry facts as well. And we all know that if we wish, history can be absolute a lead balloon. In many schools, it's the most deadening subject that exists. Because who wants, you know, who cares when the Battle of Hastings was? 1066 is correct. But that really has not furthered the cause of civilization much in the last few hundred years. Knowing the facts without being able to put it into any sort of perspective, without realizing the parameters, really doesn't carry the weight. So that's the second point regarding man that the Chumash points out to us. The third point, and that's the point that really in the modern world escapes us, I think, the most, is that individual man counts for a great deal. When the Chumash tells us stories of history, it always tells us stories in a first-person narrative regarding a certain character, a certain person, a certain family. It never tells us abroad. It's not the New York Times, where, you know, you read about trends and analyses, and it's all, you read the New York Times, and the world isn't it. No individual can influence it. And the fact that Western man in our century suffers from that Marxist poison which infects us. Marx said that everything are forces in history. It's dialectical materialism. There's no way to stop it. He said there's no way to stop the revolution from coming. There's no way to stop it. As late as a few years ago, at least publicly, the Russian communists said that capitalism must fall. It's just, you know, if they believe that, and if that's their Weltanschauung, and they're waiting for it to fall, it's very hard to make a deal with them. Because historic forces have to happen. It doesn't make any difference what we do. And Western civilization suffers from that type of fatalism. That no individual matters, no individual can stop things, and no individual, therefore, is really worth the trouble. And on the opposite side of that coin, therefore, in order to achieve historic gains, it is certainly permissible to sacrifice human life. Not only permissible, it's noble to do so. I always mentioned Chairman Mao said, you know, he's willing to sacrifice 100 million Chinese to make China a world empire, to bring it into the modern world, to make it the perfect communist state. Well, he sacrificed 100 million Chinese. Whether he achieved it or not, I don't know. But the 100 million Chinese are dead. Stalin killed 50 million people to make the perfect socialist state. So Gorbachev gets up today and gives him a hespit, right, that he's no good. But the 50 million people are dead. You can't bring them back. Where does that come from? That comes from a viewpoint that really individuals are unimportant. It's the mass, it's the nation, It's the it's society, it's the movement. That's what counts. The Torah saw it differently. And the Jewish people see it differently. And we see it as a world that has 4.5 billion individuals in it. And that the individual matters a great deal. And that because the individual matters so much, we have to look at, we ourselves are enormously important. And the Torah tells us that when Moses sent the spies to see the land of Canaan, so if we would send spies, so we would say, you know, bring back the blueprints of the Stinger missile and find out where their air bases are and find out all of the selective information which goes into our intelligence agencies. Moshe asked them, "Hayesh bo etzimayin? Is there a righteous man? They have. Is there a tzaddik left? Is Eov still alive? The proverbial Job, the famous Job, is he still alive? If he's alive, then we're not going to make it. Because he can protect an entire society, even an idolatrous pagan society, even an evil society. But a society that has Job, that has a man of his stature in its midst, can be preserved. Imayin, but if he's not there, oh boy, then it's ours. Then they have Sor Tzilam, their protector has departed." What do you mean? They're the same Canaanites with the same guns, with the same cannon, the same fortresses, with the same, you know, billion-dollar arms sale proposed in the United States Senate. It's all the same. No, it's not the same. If there's no righteous person, their society, it's not going to happen. I always say to the boys in the yeshiva that the city of Sdom was destroyed not because of 3 million evil people, it was destroyed because it didn't have 10 good people. If it would have had 10 good, the 10 good people keep the 3 million going. So our job is to be one of the 10 good people. Our job is to see that there should be some good people. Right? So it keeps the city of New York going, I'm convinced. Must be a few good people there in the outer boroughs. And that philosophy is a basic understanding that Judaism has. You all know the legend that the world exists because of 36 righteous people. The 36 righteous people are anonymous. They're not even known to themselves, which is, by the way, the measure of a righteous person. A righteous person who knows he's a righteous person is not a righteous person. 36 anonymous people. So 4.5 billion people can exist and the whole shebang can keep on going. But there are 36 righteous people. The power of an individual. Now rabbis phrase it in their inimitable fashion when they say, "Loma nivra odom yechidi." Why was only one man created? Why did the whole world start from one man? God could have made, you know, could have started with 1 billion people. It's interesting that even the anthropology professors and the secularists and those that reject any form of religion or tradition in this matter also somehow agree that we have a common ancestor. We're all taking from the same gene bank. Because I'll say, why only one man? Why didn't, you know, God could have made it. The rabbis give very interesting answers. One person shouldn't say, you know, I'm better than you are. I have greater pedigree than you. But the basic intrinsic reason is because that's it. The whole world is one man. That's all it is. And the one man is me. That's what the rabbis meant, kol olam lo nivra ola bishvili. The whole world was created for me. I'm the one man. That's a different viewpoint of life. And that's how the rabbi saw man, and that's how Jewish history saw man, and that is the continual story here. And that's why when you read the Chumash, you read that all the great events which occurred, the great wars, the great historic events, the introduction of feudalism, of imperialism, empires rising and falling, all of those great historic events are the backdrop. They are not the main story. The main story is people. The main story is the individual. The main story are the small pawns The actors in the drama are more than the drama itself. So we have, therefore, the first idea that man remains constant and the problems that face man are constant, but civilization evolves. Civilization grows. Now, what were the first 1,536 years like? Again, I didn't see the video, and I can't describe it in terms that, for instance, we could describe the Second World War. Because the Second World War, we have eyewitnesses, a great millions and millions and millions of people are still alive who experienced it. We have it on film, we have it on phonograph records, we have it in the recorded word. So at least we have a feel of it, though not a very good feel either, because as time, you all know that something that you saw, no matter how you see it again, no matter how it's recorded, etc., it's not the same. It loses. I have that feeling every year when I talk to the boys about Yom Yerushalayim, the freeing of Jerusalem and the Western Wall, etc. So I remember how I felt on that day. I cannot describe it. It's an unmatched feeling that, again, won't happen again. So even though you see the pictures and you hear the records, etc., it's not the same. Well, what happens here when we don't have pictures and we don't have the records and the recorded word is sparse? So it's harder than ever to piece it together. But there are certain highlights, again, that we are aware of. First of all, we're aware that In order for civilization to begin its trek, in other words, once man had to go out into the world, so then he needed tools. He faced a hostile environment. He lived in a dangerous world. But man is the most adaptable of all creatures. Man can live in the Arctic Circle and he can live on the equator. Man can live on the sea and he can live on land. Man is the most adaptable of all creatures because he is able, through his intellect and through his talents and ingenuity, to devise circumstances that allow him to live. So the first great invention, our rabbis tell us, which is common to all the myths in the world as well, is that of fire. The Greeks had the great myth of Prometheus, who ascended to the Mount Olympus and stole fire from the gods and brought it down to earth, and because of that he was punished by the gods. Fire is the enormous invention, because fire allows us already to deal with our environment. So the Talmud tells us fire was created Saturday night. That's why we make Havdalah. When we make Havdalah Saturday night, we make the blessing on the fire, because that's the anniversary of the creation of fire. What does it mean fire was created Saturday night, aside from the fact that fire was created Saturday night? But what does it mean that fire was created Saturday night? It's the first invention. The first 6 days are God's creation. The seventh day, everything was at rest. That Saturday night, you know, just like we are, right? You put away the talis and you come home depressed. Shabbos is over, and all of a sudden you realize the bank is going to be open Monday morning. And all the problems are here. Shabbos, you're in seventh heaven. And now the whole week starts. So the first thing that meant, the first creation of man, the first invention of man, the first step in civilization was fire. And that's a myth that's common. All cultures have it. Because mankind, in the collective memory of mankind, knows that fire was the first step. We sanctify the invention with the blessing. But that's the beginning. The beginning is fire. After fire comes tools, primitive tools, all sorts of tools. How to eke an existence out of a hostile planet. My children, we once took them to a tropical garden. So I don't remember. One of my children, a very young age, asked, how did the first man know how to eat a banana? You're supposed to peel it. So my other child, who was wise, said he watched the monkey, right? And you watch a monkey eat a banana, right? And a monkey always peels it. You never saw a monkey yet eat the banana with the peeling. But that's a basic question that troubles us all. I mean, how, you know, the first person, how did he? So you have all of these great stories, how coffee was invented. The Turkish brought the beans to Europe in the siege of Vienna, and they left so quickly that they left over the beans when the siege was lifted, and that's how coffee came. They didn't, the Europeans, they don't know what to do with the beans, so they threw it in the garbage or something, and it got wet, and all of a sudden there was a liquid, and it smelled good, and the guy got a concession from the Holy, from Leopold, the Holy Roman Emperor, and he made a fortune importing the coffee beans. And brandy, we know, was discovered by a monk that let the wine stay too long in the cask. So if you let it stand too long, it turns to vinegar. But if you let it stand long enough, it'll turn back to brandy. There are many things that are serendipity in this world, that are many inventions. But man is the ingenious creature that was able to invent it. The rabbis, again, phrase it so well. The rabbis say that for a period of time, man did not have separate digits on his hand. In other words, like the five fingers were welded together. So again, aside from the fact that the five fingers are welded together, and that's what it means, what it also means is that man couldn't do anything with his hands. He was unable to be productive. And in this world, to make it, you have to be productive. You have to be able to do things. You have to be ingenious. When man finally got his hands to be productive, that's the beginning of civilization. And in that beginning of civilization, all sorts of inventions occur. Now, the book of history regarding this 1,536 years is not the book of the Bible. It's not the Chumash, not the five books of Moses. The book of history is Chronicles, Divrei Hayomim. And there, Divrei Hayomim tells us the whole story by names. The names of the people of every generation that were instrumental in advancing civilization. In our time, we would say it's the Hall of Fame. The people that did the most to advance society in their time. And it tells us how the world grew and where it grew. Original man, according to our tradition, was in Mesopotamia. In Babylonia, the garden that was east of Eden, in our understanding is somewhere in the land of Iraq, Persia, Afghanistan, in that area of the world. That's where man came from. Leakey and the other anthropologists have discovered the oldest human skeletons they have discovered in Kenya, in Central Africa. And there are all sorts of midrashim that tell us about that also. One of which is that in the flood, all the bones from Mesopotamia were washed to Africa. But be that as it may, man began in a warm climate. And he began as an agricultural and hunting animal. Because the basic quality of all of us is that we have to eat. We have to eat every day. And that what we eat today is not sufficient for tomorrow. There are certain creatures in the world, there are certain snakes that only have to eat once every 6 months. There are certain snakes in Asia that eat once every 6 months, and they're able to hold on to it. Camels are able to drink once every 3 days, once every 4 days. Man can't do that. Man, after 3 days, 4 days, is not functioning if he doesn't have what to eat and drink. So therefore, the immediate necessity of life always was to have food, to have water, to be able just to sustain life. And that forced him into being, that forced him into the these two fields of endeavor. The rabbis immediately said that that was Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel, the two brothers. One was a shepherd, a hunter, and the other was a farmer, a person that was an agriculturalist. Those were the two ways. One way was to tame the animals and have your food, have sustenance from the animals. The other way was to tame the earth somehow and have sustenance from the earth. And those were the original occupations of man. Later, man develops. Civilization becomes more complex. There are more people. We come to the manufacture of tools, which is described for us. The invention of iron, in terms of being able to come out of stone and of flint and of bones as being the tools of mankind, and coming to the use of iron. We call it the Iron Age, the Bronze Age. Those are all advances in civilization. The rabbis tell us that Noah is famous because he invented the plow. He invented the iron plow. That was his contribution to mankind, which was in its time, it was what fire was, what the wheel was, what the basic inventions of life were. Because without the iron plow, then the earth was backbreaking work. It still is backbreaking work. There's a famous autobiography that I've read by John Kenneth Galbraith, the Nobel Prize economist, and he was the economic advisor, I think, to President Kennedy. He's a professor Samuelson, professor of economics at Harvard. A very, very clever person. A very funny book. So he writes that he grew up on a farm near Calgary in Western Canada. He's a Canadian. And he said that the first chance that he got to get out of the farm, he said, what made him an economist? He said he got a scholarship in economics. If they would have given him a scholarship, he said, in anything. He said, why anybody in his right mind wants to be a farmer, he said, all of those that attend the agricultural and mining schools are not the children of farmers. Because even today, there is no more difficult work, no harder labor. And under no other circumstances are you so subject to the vagaries of fortune as you are being a farmer. So man originally, till he became agriculturally adept, underwent a tremendous period of frustration and of difficulty. But having achieved that, then man began to, and we see this in Divrei Hayomim, he began to achieve a hegemony. He began to have families, and the families grouped into tribes, and the tribes eventually grouped into nations, which was positive. The negative part of it was that the nations fought each other, that there became a great deal of competition and rivalry. And therefore, the entire period of the 1500 years before the flood is a time of robbery, as our rabbis phrase it. Vatimole oretz chomos. It's a time of violence, a time of robbery. It's a time when the world is as unsafe as we know it today. It's a world of muggers. It's a world where everybody was afraid to venture forth. Not a stable place at all. And then there arose mass gangs. There arose heroes, giants, people who through sheer brute force were able to exert their will over others, were able to destroy others. And that's when the world started to fall apart. Because then you have exploitation, and then you have the downtrodden, then you build up a resentment in classes of society, you have class warfare, tribal warfare, all of that occurred in that period of time. There's a turning point in world history that comes in the generation of Enosh, which is three or four generations in, about 650, 700 years into the story, halfway to the flood. And Maimonides describes it to us in his Yorah HaZokah, and it's based on, again, Jewish tradition and based on the Talmud and based on a certain viewpoint. And the explanation is, what type of religion took hold in the world then? Now, one of the strange things about man is that he cannot live without religion. Even atheism is a religion. The man said, I swear by God, I'm an atheist. Atheism is a secular religion, but it has all the trappings of religion to it. But it also has its own rules and its own leadership and its own rhythm. This type of belief is based on the fact that man has to have something. Man never is satisfied without somehow dealing with the mysterious, with the impenetrable, with what is beyond us. He has to have something. He's not willing to ignore it. And it's compounded by the mystery and the fear of death, which is always the knowledge of mortality. Most psychologists are of the opinion that man is the only creature in the world who knows that he is mortal. And that therefore that colors all of our behavior. I recommend, as I recommended before on other lectures, that if you have a chance to read Ernst Becker's book called The Denial of Death, which I'm getting a few copies of, by the way, you should, because it has tremendous insights. Becker himself was an estranged Jew. He was a Jew that went through the concentration camps, etc. At the end of his life, he returned to religion. But this book is a tremendously revealing and insightful book. It's called The Denial of Death, and it really deals with human behavior, how human behavior is absolutely colored by the fact that we know that we're mortal. And that knowledge from the age that we're 3 or 4 on is the one point in life that governs all other points. And the Chumash tells us that as well. So how did religion come in the world? Well, religion came through the fact that man realized that he had to serve, or that life had to have meaning. And he did not want to believe, he could not believe that everything was at random. There had to be explanations for all of the things that occurred. And since most of what occurs in life is mysterious, is not it's beyond explanation. So therefore, he invented explanations. So in the words of Maimonides says, the Rambam says, "Bimos enosh to'us gedola." Mankind made a great error. Rambam doesn't ascribe paganism or idolatry to malice. It was an error. It was a basic error in judgment. If we can phrase it another way, it occurred because of a loss of sophistication within man. To be a monotheist, to believe in an invisible God, requires a great deal of sophistication. To the unsophisticated, what you cannot hear and what you cannot see and what you cannot understand is not. It just doesn't exist. To say that it exists on a different plane than I do requires a great deal of abstract thought, a great deal of sophistication. And that's part of the idea that the rabbi said, Lo amor et chosid, that the ignorant person is not pious. So it's not only the ignorant person. The unsophisticated person really is far, far away from piety because he cannot deal with life in a sophisticated, abstract fashion. It is not accidental that all of the progress in civilization is based upon abstract thinking. After the abstract thinking, we are able to take it and put it to practice. We're able to build a tool. But somebody has to have the abstract idea first. Someone has to have the wild theory. That abstract idea, that wild theory, is the spark of God within us. That's the Tzelem Elokim. That's the peace of God that's within us. That Einstein could think of the theory of relativity and could say that time is relative. That's an abstraction beyond all abstractions. And because of that, he was able to translate it into physics. Or Niels Bohr was able to translate it into quantum physics. Or were able to make an atom bomb or split the atom or have nuclear energy. That's all the product of abstract thinking. Because no, you can't see an atom. And you don't understand its properties. But by the power of abstraction, we are able to make it real. That's sophistication. That's why science really is godly. That's why inherently there is no conflict between advance and civilization and religion. It's only religion in the hands of unsophisticated people that it becomes a burden upon mankind, which unfortunately has happened in many, many situations in the world. The church still can't make peace with Galileo. But that presence of abstract thinking is the basis of civilization. I mean, the computer in our time, all of these things, all of the advances that have occurred, that what happens in medicine, what happens in everything else, abstract, music is abstract thinking, literature is abstract thinking, poetry. Everything that we think of, business, it's all abstract thinking. So the Rambam says that it was the loss of abstract thinking that brought about idolatry. It was the descent of unsophistication to the world that brought it about, because they could no longer abstractly conceive of a creator. So therefore they looked at the sun and the moon and the stars, which they could see, which were there. It does not require abstract thinking to see the sun. And they said, therefore, well, it could be that there's something behind the sun. But that's too hard. That's too difficult. That requires some sort of abstract thinking that I'm not willing to delve into. So I'll settle for less. I'll worship the sun. He'll know that I mean him. But meanwhile, I'll worship the sun. That's the beginning of idolatry. That's what happened in the 1500 years. I have guys in the yeshiva like that. They Rebbe, I don't have to know the Tesis. Enough that I know the Gemara, it's enough. What I have to know the little print for, right? It's enough, God will understand if I only know this. It's true, God will understand. But what happens is that you never really become a scholar if you're not able to do the little print too. It's an arrest in the sophistication, not in the knowledge, but the sophistication of the person. And that theory of abstract thinking, the lack of it is the basis of idolatry, is the basis of all paganism in the world. After a while, paganism has a life of its own, naturally. Because once I'm able to worship the sun and the moon and the stars, so then I say, today it's rainy outside, the sun isn't there, so I'll make a picture of the sun. I'll worship it in my house. Or it's too hot today to go out. And then once you get idols in the house, so then it doesn't take man long to invent rituals and to build buildings and to have a priestly caste society. All of that comes naturally. We see how it comes. And the Rambam says, that's what happened. If you want to know what happened in the after about 700 years of civilization, the main point in history after 700 years of civilization is paganism, idolatry, the lack of sophistication in the world. That, coupled with the inherent problems of trying to eke a living out of a hostile environment, of competitiveness between tribes. And don't forget, it's a little worse because it's still all almost one family. And we know that there's no fight like a family fight. Two brothers that fight is worse than two strangers. The hurt is much deeper. It lasts much longer. The bitterness is much greater. And that's what happens here in this 1500 years. These are all fights between brothers, between cousins, between uncles and nephews. All of that contributes to a chaotic situation. But there are individual people who are righteous. There are individual people in every generation that stood and said, that's not the way civilization should go. I mentioned Chanoch is one of them, the famous Enoch, whom the rabbis say was a shoemaker. You don't have to be the president, or you don't have to be the pope, and you don't have to be the person of great authority in order to be the influential person in the world. Many times in the history of the world we have had great influential people who were very, very lowly in life and who did not occupy high stature, but who left a lasting legacy to mankind, who had a great influence upon mankind. I always say that it's interesting that we are always attempting to try and figure out who the Pharaoh was in Egypt when Moses was there, but everybody knows who Moses was. And the Pharaoh was the ruler of the world. And not only that, he was the ruler of the world. He built for himself pyramids, and he built for himself all sorts of monuments. Everybody would always remember who he is. Who is he? Don't know. But smaller people, right? People who didn't count for much, always left a lasting legacy. So the Chumash tells us, in every one of these generations leading up to the flood, in the development of civilization, there were people who warned that they're going down the wrong road. The last of them was the great Methuselah, who God allowed to live longer than anyone else. Many say that's a punishment. We see that in Jewish viewpoint also, regarding Choni Amago, you know, the Jewish Rip Van Winkle. If a person outlives his time, he outlives, even if he is granted, Choni Amago was not ill, and he didn't have any of the infirmities of old age, but he outlived his time. He didn't have his society, and he saw a society that he could not influence. No, he was a curio. Nobody looked at him as normal. That's what happened to Methuselah also. People came to see the great Methuselah, right? You want to see a guy 969 years old? They have to line up around the block. It's a freak show in the circus. Everybody comes to see them. But they have no influence anymore. It's not part of society. And therefore, they couldn't, so to speak, hold up the heavens any longer. They couldn't prevent the disaster that they all knew was going to occur. The disaster was that man was going to destroy himself. So God took it in hand and God destroyed it. But it's man that destroyed it, not God destroying it. And we read that in the Chumash very clearly. Lo yodun ruchi bo'adam. God said, man, I can't. God interferes. The viewpoint of the flood, which we'll discuss next week, the viewpoint of the flood is that the flood saved mankind. It didn't destroy it. If it wouldn't have been for the flood, no one would have survived. Man would have destroyed himself completely. Just as in our time, we're well aware of the capabilities of self-destruction. Doesn't take much. 6 Meshugoyim will push the button and it's all over. So God has to, so to speak, intervene to save man from himself. So all of these basic problems of civilization are here from the beginning of time onwards. And they are the stuff from which the story of civilization is built. And in the geographic sense, mankind moves from Mesopotamia around the entire Fertile Crescent of Asia Minor. It moves as far east as Greece, as far west as India, and eventually China, as far south as Egypt, and then further south across the Sahara into Africa. But it is in this fertile crescent, in this area, bounded, let us say, by Turkey, by Iran, by Egypt, that the world story is going to be played out. It isn't that there aren't people anywhere else, but this is the center of the story, the center of the story of civilization. And we'll see that as man moved, and especially after the flood as he moved, then the problems of man became known wherever he went. And that becomes the basic story of civilization as we know it today.